Our next case is A24-0379, Aldra Olson versus St. Luke's Hospital of Duluth. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust the podium up to your level, and begin, please, by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Matthew Corte, on behalf of the appellant Aldra Olson, the widow and wrongful death trustee for her husband, Scott Olson. With me today is my colleague, Rachel Barrett. May it please the court, counsel. The sole issue on appeal today concerns causation and whether under the Minnesota Supreme Court's recent Rigwall opinion, appellant provided enough evidence specific to the case to enable a jury to make a reasonable inference that respondent's failure to provide Scott Olson the requisite medical care consistent with accepted medical standards on July 22nd, July 28th, and July 29th, 2019 was a substantial contributing factor in his death. That is, had the proper care been provided when it was called for, days, if not more than a week, before Mr. Olson succumbed to acute respiratory distress syndrome, the harm he and his family later suffered would have been avoided. Because sufficient evidence was provided for a reasonable jury to properly find that St. Luke's negligence indeed played a substantial part in Scott Olson's death, the lower court's grant of summary judgment was, with all due respect, inappropriate and should be reversed. Now, I'd like to, again, refer back to the Minnesota Supreme Court's recent decision in Rigwall that was issued earlier this summer. It certainly is a factually analogous case. Like here, it involved a pulmonary infection. Like here, it involved a delay in diagnosis and treatment. Also, like here, it involved the development of acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. And like here, it involves experts asserting that had treatment been timely provided, that patient, Amy Rigwall, would not have died. Now, legally, the Supreme Court clarified that a medical malpractice plaintiff's burden of proof on causation at the summary judgment stage. It stated that a plaintiff need only provide an outline of the chain of causation. A heightened burden to provide a detailed outline does not exist, and it's not required. Now, to meet the evidentiary benchmark set forth by Rigwall, a plaintiff need only provide opinions with proper foundation and enough information about the specific case to allow a jury to make reasonable inferences connecting the provider's conduct to the harm. Now, as the experts in Rigwall satisfied their burden of proof on causation, so too does appellant's evidence here. In fact, appellant's evidence exceeds that which was provided in Rigwall. Now, before
I
get
in the court's order and in respondent's brief, they're sort of focusing on the July date and basically saying, well, you know, you haven't said why that was the tipping point. So what is your response to that argument?
We did clarify and specify why that was the tipping point. But July 31st.
And is that in your is that an exhibit, the second supplemental disclosure of Dr. McBride?
It is, Your Honor. On paragraph 11, Dr. McBride specifies that the critical point in care, it's the last paragraph, was the morning of July 31st, as that precedes the onset of acute respiratory distress syndrome.
You know, it's been a while since I tried medical malpractice cases, so this is kind of a new thing for me. When did it start where you sort of draft the document and then there's a supplemental verification from the doctor saying, I agree? I generally just used to see the affidavits from the doctor. So when did all this start?
I don't know the exact date that the statute allowed this or was provided for this, but under Rule 145.682, this is the practice in medical malpractice cases. Absolutely. And Your Honor, to that July 31st date, it really is The date that the window to provide effective treatment, antifungal treatment for Mr. Olson's fungal infection, that's when it closed. That's the date that it closed, the time that it closed, right? The allegations of medical malpractice in this case occurred on July 22nd, July 28th, and July 29th. And it's our burden to connect those incidents of malpractice to the harm at issue. And Your Honor, I would submit that we have done that with the expert reports, and that the lower court's focus on that July 31st date actually miscast our evidence and our claims by ignoring the prior conducts of malpractice. Now, I would like to emphasize also for the court that review here, the standard of review, is de novo. So, and because of that, the court's tasked with taking a fresh look at the evidence to decide for itself whether it was sufficient to overcome summary judgment. We need not spend much time to figure out how the lower court got to the conclusion it got to or how it focused on the July 31st date. It's really not at issue here. You're reviewing the evidence fresh and for yourself. And again, the focus and our claims are on the malpractice that happened on July 22nd, July 28th, and July 29th, and how that led to the ultimate harm. Now, and I will submit to you that you will find the evidence and the opinions are more than sufficient to satisfy plaintiff's burden and raise genuine issues of material fact for a jury to evaluate and decide. Now, so let me get to our proof. Here, the appellant's experts explained that given Mr. Olson's non-resolving pneumonia, despite multiple rounds of oral and IV antibiotics, across multiple admissions, and his worsening diagnostic findings and clinical conditions, that the standard of care called for respondent to provide a specific course of medical treatment on at least three separate occasions across those two admissions. That treatment would have called for ordering fungal studies, providing for a bronchoscopy, or involving infectious disease, any of which at any of those separate points in time would have identified Scott's infection as fungal and triggered immediate, appropriate, and timely antifungal treatment. Now, had the standard of care been followed and the requisite medical care been provided on any of those dates, our experts opine to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that Mr. Olson's infection would have been diagnosed, would have been treated at a time when antifungal treatment was effective to resolve the infection and return Scott, more likely than not, to his home, to his family, without any ill effects. Our experts opine how that was, how respondents' failure to provide appropriate medical care when it was called for led to the infection's further spread, its consolidation, its ruinous impact on his body, including renal failure, respiratory failure, and ultimately his death. All our experts provided opinions that St. Luke's negligence played a substantial contributing part in his resulting death. Dr. McBride certainly provided the most robust opinions in that regard, describing how, in paragraph 6 of his second report, how blastomycosis damaged Scott's lungs, and how left untreated, it led to a cascading effect of other issues for Scott. Now, reinforcing those expert opinions are the actual medical records detailing the subsequent deterioration. Our experts refer to those findings and Scott's condition. For example, after the July 22nd discharge, appellant's experts noted that Scott returned to St. Luke's Hospital septic, hypoxic. His scans, his CT scans, his x-rays were substantially worse. His left lung was had full consolidation. His right lung started to have the infection. And then after the...
In page 34 of respondent's brief, the respondent is trying to distinguish Rigwall. And she notes, in that case, in Rigwall, plaintiff's expert relied on medical studies showing that for each hour of delay in administering antibiotics, the risk of morbidity and mortality for someone in the plaintiff's condition increases. Now, in Dr. McBride's affidavit, do you have anything that kind of, you know, establishes, you know, to that specificity, you know, that, you know, time is of the essence and earlier is better?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where should I look for that?
It's cited in, again, his second disclosure, the paragraph 11 in the last...
11.
Yes, in the last paragraph. It's the Schwartz study. And in that study, and also there are other studies, the McBride study cited in paragraph 5 of his report. I believe there's another study cited in paragraph 8 of his study. These all identify that the onset of acute respiratory distress syndrome is a dire condition. So treatment before that happens is key. And having suspicion, early suspicion, to treat it is
no. And I absolutely agree with you. But what I'm, you know, what she's trying. Yes, I see that, and you know that makes sense. I mean, you know, for everything. Yeah. I mean, you know, best to get penicillin sooner rather than later. But if I was to look at these studies, does it sort of have a specific timeline? Like, boy, you know, even a day late makes the difference, you know, between getting the shot and not getting the shot. Is there anything like that?
It's all pivoted off of acute respiratory distress syndrome, okay, or blastomycosis. And the Schwartz study in particular has mortality rates. It cites other studies, and it says that mortality in the presence of acute respiratory distress syndrome is in excess of 50%. It cites some studies that put that number at 89%. And respondents point out the fact that Schwartz has language that states that while survivability is inversely related to clinical illness severity, it's not for ARDS severity. And with all due respect to respondents, I think they've misread that to mean something it doesn't. What that means is that as survivability or as critical illness goes up, survivability goes down, but ARDS, it does not matter. No matter what, whether you have a little, it's just starting, or whether you have severe ARDS, it doesn't matter. The mortality rate is the same. A little dab will do you with ARDS. Death is at your doorstep if you have it develop. So continuing on, Your Honors, the medical records did show that after the July 28th readmission that his condition worsened, which reinforces the expert's opinion about the impact of untreated blastomycosis. After the July 28th readmission, Mr. Olson had worsening lung sounds on clinical exam by the nurses. He had new right lung consolidation that was noted in the records that were cited as of July 31st. Obviously, he developed acute respiratory distress syndrome. He had more multi-organ failure, necrotic tissue, bowel perforations, and ultimately his death. These are all consistent with appellant's expert opinions submitted in the case. But beyond that,
is there anything in Dr. McBride's affidavits that indicates that, I'm just going to call it ARDS, yeah, was settling in on the afternoon of the 31st of July?
Yes, that's that same opinion, Your Honor. Paragraph 11, that
it says it's a critical time for survival.
Yes, because
that precedes the development of ARDS.
That's right, Your Honor.
So I should focus on that sentence.
Yes. Okay. And we also have testimony that we cited from respondents' own pulmonologist, the treating pulmonologist for Mr. Olson, that said, look, the signs and the symptoms and the deterioration that Scott Olson experienced on the 31st, going from 2 liters being maxed out on a ventilator, that was classic for ARDS. Their own testimony. We cited medical records in our brief pinpointing that 2 liter demand for oxygen at 3:55 in the morning on July 31st. Within 12 hours, we cited another medical record. It was already up to 5. That deterioration had occurred over the afternoon of July 31st, which reinforces Dr. McBride's opinion as to when the important and the critical point for treatment closed. Beyond the how, respondents' negligence led to the condition. Dr. McBride, Dr. Jennison, and Dr. Wahidi also explained why the appropriate treatment, had it been provided at the time it was called for, would have prevented the harm that followed. Dr. Jennison at paragraph 26 in his report, Dr. McBride at 16 to 17 in his report, his opening report, and Dr. Wahidi, paragraph 23 to 24 and 28. They explained, Dr. McBride in particular, in his second supplemental disclosure, explained specifically the mechanism with which antifungals work. and how, on a biological and cellular level, they attack fungal cells to kill them at that cellular level. They also
I'm looking at paragraph 9. If Mr. Olson had begun treatment by the morning of July 31st, prior to intubation, respiratory failure, ARDS, ARDS, and ECMO, he likely would have returned to his usual life activities within months.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. And in paragraph 10, Dr. McBride specifies that Mr. Olson would have more likely than not received Lambie at that time. And Lambie, as he describes in paragraph 8 of that same report, is an immediate acting and therapeutic antifungal. They, as we've already addressed, appellant's experts further specified why such care would have been timely in these circumstances, and that as long as Scott had received those antifungals before the onset of ARDS, his outcome would have been a positive one. And that is, again, before the afternoon of the 31st. That's not a general assertion or a broad proclamation by Dr. McBride, but are opinions that are specifically tied to the case, to Scott's condition, to his care, and when his ARDS began to set in. Again, there are a number of peer-reviewed studies that Dr. McBride cites as support. Your Honor, I understand my time is up. As this court has often recognized, the question of whether a defendant's negligence is the cause of a plaintiff's injury is generally an issue for a jury to decide. It's no different here. Consistent with Rigwall, appellant's evidence satisfied her burden at this stage, providing enough information that was specific to the facts in this case to enable a jury to make a reasonable inference without speculating that St. Luke's negligence played a substantial contributing factor in Scott's death. That's all that was required. We therefore ask this court to reverse the lower court's judgment and remand the case for trial. I'm happy to address any further questions.
I think we're good.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. Christine Chambers on behalf of respondent St. Luke's Hospital. The plaintiff's burden of proof and the standard of what they have to prove in a medical negligence claim hasn't changed. They still have to show there's a violation of the standard of care. That violation caused harm, or in this case, Mr. Olson's death. Since this is a delayed diagnosis claim, they have to be able to connect the actual delay in, or alleged delay in the diagnosis to his ultimate death 2 months later. Because, of course, no provider gave Mr. Olson blastomycosis. He would have had the disease. He would have had symptoms of the disease no matter when it was diagnosed and treated. So it's key for the plaintiff's experts in this case to make that connection between when the delay actually caused the harm versus the disease itself.
And why, Ms. Chambers, why doesn't paragraph 9 in, I guess it's the second affidavit of Dr. McBride, why doesn't that get us there for the appellant?
So Dr. McBride's...
Because, I mean, we've read your briefs, and,
yes,
you know, you're hitting very hard as well. You know, they never said why July 31st was important. And, you know, it does say, if Mr. Olson had begun treatment by the morning of July 31st, 2019, prior to blah, 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 you know the rest of it. Why, you know, I mean... Rigwall seems to have moved the ball, and it seems like that's enough, that's, you know, good enough for government. So why am I wrong, Ms. Chambers?
Yes, a couple of points, Your Honor. One, this conclusion that if he had begun treatment by the morning of July 31st, prior to intubation, respiratory failure, ARDS, ECMO, that he would have been able to return to normal activities. Respondent's position all along has been, we did that. We treated with an antifungal prior to the inception of all of those things. So the trial court really narrowed in on, okay, well, we treated with an antifungal on July 31. Plaintiff's experts did not say that the antifungal we treated with was inappropriate or was a violation of the standard of care to use the specific antifungal that was given in this particular case, Itraconazole. So what's the distinction between the morning and the evening? You know, that is the focus from the trial court, because if the plaintiff's expert doesn't specifically describe what is the key there with those several hours, then the jury has to speculate on why the treatment in the morning would have prevented his ultimate death, but treatment in the evening would not have. So the closest we get in all of the disclosures from all three of the plaintiff's experts, the closest we get on describing that point is right here, what you're hitting on, Your Honor, in paragraph 9. But respondents have shown that the treatment was prior to, in the afternoon or evening of July 31, was prior to all of these things. So then what's the distinction between the morning and the afternoon? So they still haven't gotten there. And to the extent that they have now taken the position that, well, but the treatment to be appropriate should have been Lambie, should have been a different type of antifungal. In Dr. McBride's third disclosure, his second supplemental disclosure, the one that was submitted with their opposition to summary judgment motion, he adds that he thinks it's causative that there wasn't treatment with Lambie on that particular date. However, he never says that it was a violation of the standard of care. So even though the motion began with arguments about causation, we have kind of reversed the issues now, because they still have to have the link between the violation of the standard of care to causing injury. And they actually have the opposite problem with that particular opinion from Dr. McBride. And they've certainly had a number of opportunities to disclose expert opinion and to make a clear outline of causation on that point, and they haven't done that. So I submit that that is also insufficient to satisfy their burden on causation in the case. I think the key that distinguishes this case from the issues in the Rigwall case is that there's a very condensed timeline that was involved in Rigwall. The plaintiff was treated within a few hours of when the aspiration pneumonia allegedly began. She was critically ill within those 3 hours by the time she was taken to the hospital. And the expert opinions in that case were that there had to be immediate treatment, but immediate treatment talking about a 3-hour window of time. So it's true that she ultimately developed ARDS, and there are some factual similarities in that sense with Mr. Olson in this case. But in this case, we're talking about a window of treatment of several days, and then his ultimate death was 2 months after the blastomycosis diagnosis was made. So
But isn't their argument, yes, he died later, but the whole point is he wouldn't have died at all had you all done something, and I'm not saying you should have, you know, on the 31st, to catch the ARDS, and why isn't that good enough, counsel?
You're right in that the when ARDS set in is important in the case, because that is the closest, most specific opinion we have on kind of the tipping point on causation from the expert disclosures in the case, and that is from Dr. McBride's third disclosure. Based on the medical records, all of the treatment was done prior to the onset of ARDS. So even if we accept as true Dr. McBride's opinions for the purposes of summary judgment, it still doesn't satisfy their burden, because we have already done that. We've provided the treatment prior to the inception of ARDS,
so,
which was not true in the Rigwall case.
So it sounds like what you're saying is what they needed to do was say on the 31st, you know, he needed to get formula X. And by God, if he had gotten formula X, he'd be alive today. And because there's nothing that specific, they lose. Is that a fair statement?
I think, Your Honor, they have to.
Because, I mean, you keep saying, you know, we did the treatment, he still got ARDS, and he died, and that's a tragedy. But you seem to be focusing on, no, they had to explain specifically what should have been done then, and they didn't, so they lose.
They do have to describe what should have been done then, because otherwise the jury has to speculate, particularly given the duration of treatment that was at issue in this case. I think that is different than in the Rigwall case, like I said, where there was a very condensed timeline. They have chosen the onset of ARDS as a key time frame that is stated from their expert disclosures. So our point is, okay, if that is the key time frame, then we satisfied it because we provided the treatment prior to the ARDS. So that's why there has been focus on that particular point of no return, if you will, because that is how they framed it within their expert disclosures. And the other way they framed it, as I touched on earlier, was about the specific antifungal that was given, but they didn't then connect the dots between a violation of the standard of care to the causation to death. So in either sense, the disclosures are deficient in terms of setting out their outline of causation.
You know, you certainly did a very nice job trying to distinguish Rigwall.
Thank you.
But at the end of the day, it seems like, as I indicated, the continuum has changed now, and Rigwall seems to suggest that it's changed enough so that you lose on summary judgment. And, you know, whether that's right or wrong, I'm not going there. But it does seem like Rigwall has changed it. And a lot of the cases that would have applied earlier is better, well, you got to look at it a little differently now. And Rigwall, so explain to me specifically why Rigwall, under Rigwall, you still win. And what language in Rigwall should we be focusing on?
Sure. So,
and aren't you lucky to have Judge Larkin on the panel, who was on Rigwall below? I suppose it would have been better if you had both of us, but you know, you take what you get.
And following up to Judge Connolly's question, you know, the Supreme Court, I believe, said in reversing this court, you know, admittedly, older language from our cases would have supported this approach, but no more. I mean, it does seem that they've changed the standard, lowered the bar in terms of what needs to be presented to avoid summary judgment in terms of causation.
Yes, understood. And I think the key, however, is the Rigwall decision. It's on page 37. It says their experts must provide the how and why of causation. And that's still, they still haven't done that in respondents' view. And it is discussed in the decision as well that the jury has to have enough so that they're not speculating. That's always been true. That's still true. If there's going to be opinions from their expert that it has to have been done by a certain time frame, they have to be able to articulate why, because otherwise the jury has to speculate. And when we're talking about a few hours difference between treatment of one kind in the morning and treatment of another kind in the evening, they haven't set forth an explanation about why that period of time is important, and the jury should not have to fill in those gaps. The jury would have to be speculating on that point, and that's improper. So they haven't done the how and the why in the sense of this key period of time and why that key period of time means he would not have recovered from an illness that killed him 2 months later versus he would have been ill for some period of time and then he would have recovered. I just also wanted to note when we were talking about the specific antifungal medication that was given, there's been at least in Dr. McBride's most recent disclosure, the allegation that it should have been Lambie, that would have only been the appropriate medication at the time. As I noted, he never said that it was a violation of the standard of care to give medication that was given in this case. And if he had said that, it would really be contradictory to both his first disclosure as well as Wahidi's disclosure, both of which state that itraconazole is regularly given, commonly given, to treat fungal infections like blastomycosis. So the plaintiff's expert cannot, after there's been a summary judgment motion filed and there's a need to maybe expand on his opinion, say something that's contradictory to what was in his initial opinion.
So you don't think paragraph 11 in the second affidavit of Dr. McBride does it either? And why not? Because, I mean, here he is talking about in, you know, the paragraph beginning with nevertheless, you know, that the risk is low when it's timely diagnosed and treated. So you're saying that's too vague, and they had to explain, you know, well, it's got to be, if he got formula X on July 31st alive, he didn't, you know, know, you know, you're going to die. Okay.
Yeah, the key, Your Honor, is, well, what does timely diagnose and treated, what does that mean? You know, it has to be specified more concretely than timely diagnosis, particularly when we're talking about a case like this where the treatment was for, and you know, there were several days of treatment. He was in the hospital for several days. He died 2 months later. So that, again, I think is a distinguishing factor from Rigwall, where it was 3-hour period of time, at which point it's undisputed, I think, in that case, that the plaintiff was critically ill after 3 hours, and that's certainly not the case here. So I think the plaintiffs are still obligated to specify, what does timely diagnosis and treatment mean? And there's a lot of conclusory language in all three of their experts' disclosures that we haven't discussed in a lot of detail, and I don't think we need to, because we've really zeroed in what's the most specific timeline that's been given, and that's the one from Dr. McBride's opinion about the morning of the 31st. But what about looking at
Rigwall, right before the conclusion, we also disagree with ARC's assertion, there is no evidence in the record showing that an early administration of antibiotics would have interrupted Amy's progression to more serious illness or death. And then ARC seizes on the language, blah, blah, blah. But then Dr. Kieperman expressly opined in his affidavit that early and aggressive intervention with antibiotics decreases both morbidity and mortality in patients with sepsis and septic shock. I mean, that seems to be sort of like the same thing McBride is saying in paragraph 11 when he's talking about all these studies about blastomycosis. Why am I wrong?
Yeah, I think the distinction there, Your Honor, and it was kind of to your question to Mr. Corte, is that the studies that were discussed in the Rigwall decision were specifically spelling out, you can tell from the medical literature within 1 hour delay in treatment, this is going to be the outcome, and in another hour, this is going to be the outcome. And that's not the same specificity that's in the medical literature that's cited by Dr. McBride. We can talk about overall mortality rate, what is the likelihood of people surviving this disease, but the literature that is discussed by the plaintiff's experts doesn't say, well, if you get treatment within 1 hour, this is going to be the outcome. If you get treatment within another hour, this is going to be the outcome. And you're looking at a 3-hour window of time where you can really, it's a lot easier, I think, under the facts of the Rigwall case and with the literature that was discussed in that case, to be able to set forth that outline of the causation chain. Whereas here, because there's such a longer period of time, that isn't how the literature reads. It doesn't say, yes, well, if he had gotten this medication at this time, but if he had gotten the same medication 6 hours later, this would have been the outcome. We don't have that in the literature. And we also don't have that in Dr. McBride's opinion. And I think that's a key omission. So I see that my time is up. I'm obviously happy to entertain other questions, but otherwise we would just respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers.
Thank you.
Mr. Corte, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Chambers' argument really just highlights all the genuine disputes of material facts that are at issue on causation, the timing of when ARDS developed for Mr. Olson, whether they provided an antifungal before that or after that. I would submit they did not, Your Honor. They focused their brief on the diagnosis of ARDS occurring on August 1st, but just because you chart something on a patient doesn't mean it didn't exist beforehand. So I just want to point that out, that there are a number of genuine issues, a material fact at issue that should have precluded summary judgment here. I also want to reiterate our claims and the thrust of our claims that the malpractice occurred on July 22nd. Had the proper care been provided at that point in time, an antifungal would have been prescribed and administered well before ARDS, almost over a week before ARDS developed. Same thing on July 28th. Had the proper care been provided, the fungal infection would have been diagnosed immediately. Antifungal treatment provided immediately July 28th. July 29th, the bronchoscopy. Our experts say it was a deviation from the standard of care not to order one given the condition and Mr. Olson's health. Had that bronchoscopy been performed on the 29th, even on the 30th, an immediate diagnosis of a fungal infection would have occurred. Antifungal medication would have been prescribed well before the onset of ARDS. The window of treatment closed on the 31st, but the malpractice occurred well before it. So I just want to focus on that. It's had the proper care been provided when it was called for, all these conditions would have been avoided because the antifungal medication would have been prescribed and administered during the time that it was effective to treat it.
So here I should be focusing on paragraphs 12 and 13 of Dr. McBride's first affidavit. Where you're talking about the July 22nd, July 28th, July 20th, the 22nd dates.
Yes, Your Honor, and Dr. Jennison provided opinions that it was a deviation from the standard of care for St. Luke's to discharge Mr. Olson on the 22nd. Also, Dr. Jennison opined that it was a deviation from the standard care not to involve infectious disease on the 28th, the day of the readmission, not to order the bronchoscopy. Dr. Wahidi opined in paragraph 24 of his opinion that the bronchoscopy should have been performed on the 29th and that that would have led to appropriate antifungal treatment immediately. And the records even bear that out. When the bronchoscopy was later performed on the 1st, after Mr. Olson succumbed to ARDS, after he was transferred to the ICU, after he was put on a mechanical ventilator to help him breathe, within a matter of an hour or two, he was diagnosed with blastomycosis. So just want to reinforce that piece and what our claims actually are in this case. Seeing no further questions, thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any others, though.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Corte. Thank you, Ms. Chambers. The matter is submitted. We'll be issuing our decision within 90 days.